Next is the refutation of the position that the self is different from the aggregates. Question: the self and the aggregates are not intrinsically one, but what fallacy is there in asserting that they are intrinsically different? Reply: Nagarjuna's fundamental retreater states the fallacy in this. If the self were other than the aggregates, it would not have the characteristics of the aggregates. If the self were essentially different from the aggregates, it would not have the aggregates' characteristics of arising, remaining and disintegrating, because there is no connection between the two. For example, a horse is something other than a cow, and so does not have the characteristics of a cow. If someone still thinks, take the Chandrakirti's clever, this syllogism based on what others accept, the aggregates cannot be the basis for the conventional imputation of a self and cannot be objects apprehended as a self, because the self is non-composite, like a flower in the sky or nirvana. If the self did not arise and disintegrate, then it would be permanent, since there is no way to avoid the implication that the self would be permanent. It would be pointless to impute a self, because as Buddha Palita points out, it would be impossible to engage in virtue or turn away from non-virtue. Furthermore, if the self had an intrinsic nature different from the defining characteristics of the five aggregates, that is, being suitable to be form, then this would have to be evident, just as a form and mind, for example, one observably different. Since the self is not apprehended in that way, it has no other meaning apart from the characteristics of the aggregates, as Nagarjuna states and also Chandrakirti states. Non-Buddhist philosophers, not realizing that self is a mere name and yet seeing that it is untenable for it to be one with the aggregates, superimpose a self which is something other than the aggregates as a matter of trinit. However, the ordinary conventional consciousness in their mind streams do not see it that way. You should repeatedly practice so as to reach solid certainty that arguments such as this contradict the existence of a self that is essentially different from the aggregates. For if you do not develop genuine certainty about the critique of the possessions of one and different, then even though you may decide that the person lacks intrinsic existence, it will be just an unproved preposition, hence you will not obtain the authentic view. Seeking to analyze whether the person existed in reality, you should analyze whether the person, if existent in reality, would be one with or different from the aggregates. If the person were one with the aggregates, then there are conclusive criticisms such as the implication that agent or object, example fire and fuel, would be one. If fire and fuel are held to be one, you must use mundane valid cognition to refute that position. A tenet that is not shared by both parties is not an effective critique. Likewise, there is the argument to the position that the self and the aggregates are different, that if they were essentially different, then like form and mind, they would have to be seen as separate, yet they are not. This is presented in terms of the non-apprehension of such difference by ordinary consciousness. So unique tenets are not an effective critique. Next 3 points is how those arguments also refute each of the remaining positions. If the self and the aggregates were intrinsically different, there would be two ways in which they could be basis and dependent, like yogurt in a bowl. Either the self could exist in dependence upon the aggregates, or the aggregates could exist in dependence upon the self. However, as in the explanation of the chariot, since they are not intrinsically different, they do not exist as basis and dependent. As Chandrakirti's commentary on the Middle Way states, the self does not intrinsically depend on the aggregates, and the aggregates do not intrinsically depend on the self. While such conceptions could be correct if they were intrinsically different, since they are not intrinsically different, those are misconceptions. The position that the self possesses the aggregates is also similar to what was explained with regard to the chariot, so it should be understood accordingly. Having cattle is, for example, Devadatta's having oxen. Having form is, for example, Devadatta's having form. Is a mere group of aggregate the self. This is also incorrect, because the self is said to be imputed in dependence upon the five aggregates, and it is not tenable for the basis of imputation to be the object imputed. Furthermore, Chandrakirti's commentary on the Middle Way and explanation of the Middle Way commentary state the fallacy that if a mere collection of aggregates were the self, agent and object would be one. This is because anyone who claims that the self appropriates the individual aggregates must accept that it appropriates all five aggregates. Hence, it would appropriate the collection of the aggregates as well. This passage from the commentary on the Middle Way means that the collection is the basis to which the self is imputed, but is not the self. This makes it clear that you must also assert such with regard to the continuum of the aggregates. So just as chair does not intrinsically exist in any of the seven ways, but is still posited in dependence upon its parts, the self does not intrinsically exist in any of the seven ways, one with the aggregates, different from the aggregates and so forth, yet is still imputed in dependence upon the aggregates. This proves what the Buddha stated succinctly, treating chariot and self as an example and exemplified. Fourth, how the person appears like an illusion based on that refutation. Illusion is said to have two meanings. Statements that the ultimate truth is like an illusion, for instance, mean that although it is established as merely existence, its true existence is negated. Statements that forms and such are illusions mean that what appears as a form while being empty of intrinsic existence is like an illusion. It's the latter of this that I am concerned with here. The latter also carries the meaning of illusion in the former sense. It is not always certain that the former usage carries the meaning of illusion in this latter sense. How do we establish the latter sense of illusion? We use two kinds of awareness, one that apprehends an appearance and one that ascertains emptiness. For example, how can you know that an appearance of a horse or elephant is an illusory or false appearance? You need both a visual consciousness that sees an illusory horse or elephant and the mental consciousness that knows that the horse or elephant does not exist as it appears. Likewise, to be certain that the person, for instance, is an illusory or false appearance, you need both the undeniable appearance of person to a conventional consciousness and the ascertainment by reasoned knowledge that the person is empty of essential or intrinsic existence. Reasoned knowledge does not establish that the appearance exists, while conventional valid cognition does not establish that it is empty of intrinsic existence. Consequently, you need both reasoned knowledge that searches to see whether things intrinsically exist and conventional awareness that apprehends forms and such as existent. While some say that there are many ways to make form appear like an illusion, it is unnecessary to exert yourself at techniques for generating such, for such appearances spontaneously present themselves to the conventional consciousness that apprehends those forms. Analyzing them often with reasoning that examines whether they intrinsically exist, you develop a strong certainty that intrinsic existence is refuted. Then when you see an appearance arise, it appears like an illusion. There is no separate way to set up an illusion like emptiness. Also, as explained above, if you fail to limit the object of negation, when you use reason to investigate whether the self and the aggregates are one, different, and so forth, then when you see the arguments that contradict those positions, you will think persons and such do not exist at all, or things such as persons are non-things, empty of all functions like the horns of a rabbit and such. This is a nihilistic view. Therefore, you should be aware that this is a point where you may slip with regard to the correct view, as Arya Deva says, and also Chandrakirti in his following stanza says. Thus, there would be a fallacy if the reasoned knowledge that searches to see whether things intrinsically exist were to apprehend the mere illusory as existent, yet you definitely must develop in place of the intrinsic existence that is reputed under rational analysis and apprehension of the existence of things that are merely illusory. So there is no fallacy, for Chandrakirti's commentary on the 400 stanza says that an illusory object must be left as a remainder. When you refute the essential or intrinsic existence of a seedling, as long as the effectiveness of the reasoning does not deteriorate, reason analyzes whether intrinsic existence is tenable. You do not develop an apprehension of the seedling as intrinsically existent. However, if you think that the seedling's love of intrinsic existence is true existence, or that the illusion-like appearance of that which is empty of intrinsic existence itself true existence, this is a misapprehension that you must refute using reasoning. Something that beyond this, even the apprehension of the illusory as existent, involves clinging to apprehension of illusoriness, and thus must be eliminated. pay no heed to this notion, or else you will incur a great fallacy, namely, that any certainty about dependent arising would be impossible. I have already explained this several times. This is undoubtedly a case of failing to distinguish between the existence of the illusory object and the true existence of the illusory object. When your analysis of an object uses reason to obliterate it, you first think it is not there. Then as you also see the analyzer, yourself, and in the same way, there is no one even to ascertain that non-existence. So with no way to determine what something is or is not, it begins to seem that what appears has become vague and indistinct. This comes about based upon reason refuting everything without distinguishing intrinsic existence and its absence from mere existence and its absence. Thus, this sort of emptiness is an emptiness that destroys dependent arising. Therefore, illusoriness, as we use the term, definitely does not refer to the rising of a vague, indistinct appearance brought on by this kind of realization. Therefore, upon reasoned analysis, you come to think this person lacks even the slightest essential or objective existence. On that basis, it is not difficult simply to have this appearance seem vague and indistinct. That sort of experience comes to everyone who aspires to an understanding of Mother Maker tenets, and hears a little of the teaching that shows how things like intrinsic nature. Still, it is difficult to develop certainty about both, one, the complete refutation of essential or intrinsic nature, and two, the presentation of those very persons who lack intrinsic nature as accumulators of karma, experiencers of those effects of karma, and so forth. It scarcely happens that someone combines the capacity to posit both of these, so it is very difficult to find the Mother Maker view. Without that combination, it is undeniable that as the certainty about the philosophical view increases, certainty about the behavioral aspects of the practice decreases. Insofar as certainty about the behavioral aspect increases, certainty about the view decreases. There is no way to develop equally strong certainty about both. Therefore, you will definitely fall either into one extreme, the superimposition, conceiving intrinsic existence, the eternalist view, the view of things as existing intrinsically, or else the other extreme, the mistaken denial, holding that things are devoid of the capacity to perform functions, the nihilistic view, the view of things as utterly non-existent, as the King of Concentration Sutra states. So we stop today's session here, and I hope I will be able to, finish it tomorrow. So tomorrow, I will confer the Bodhisattva vow as is found in the chapter of morality from the Bodhisattva Bhumi. And then if I couldn't finish the rest of the reading, I will do it after giving our Avalokiteshvara initiation on 9th. Lozandrabhaya tembenye morendo sajesho. This is the minister from the Department of Culture and Religion. This 8th March is the day when the Chinese declared martial law, and it is now 15 years since they declared that martial law on that day. During that Chinese operation, many Tibetans died, and even today many are languishing in prison and under operation, and particularly the pension, young pension lama, which is recognized by His Holiness President Gyendun, and many nationalistic Tibetans are today under either in prison or under house arrest, or have completely disappeared, and instead they have recognized their own pension, Rinpoche reincarnation, and making false advertisements, and people are asked not to have His Holiness's photos, and even with the slightest cause for excuses, people can be beaten and imprisoned. So today on this occasion, we pray that Sanche Rinpoche and Sanche Gyalo Rinpoche and others who are suffering in prison be liberated. And we, on this occasion, we recall the kindness of those who have maintained their determination for the cause of the Tibetan freedom. And on this occasion, we pray that they are always taken care of by the compassionate mind of the Avalokiteshvara, and that in the end they all actualize the five primordial states of Buddhahood. And we also pray that all those Tibetans who are still suffering in Tibet and who are under constant fear from the Chinese operation, we pray that they be liberated from such fear. And we pray that the truth for the Tibetans soon prevail, and that the Tibetans are able to get united and go back to Tibet based on His Holiness's middle way approach. And we also pray that all the faults of the five degenerations disappear, and it's for this aim that we are arranging this elaborate offering before this holy temple, and making offerings to the temple and also to the sanghas, and during this occasion of His Holiness's sacred teaching, we also would like to offer a tea offering to all those who are attending this teaching, and we urge all of you to join us to pray for peace from the Department of Culture and Religion of the Tibetan government in exile. Tsongkhapa, in his song of experience on the stages of the path, he says, not only one pointed meditation is necessary for standing the for achieving a certain higher spiritual states, but even in terms of cultivation of special insight, where you analyze the natures of different objects, there are also one pointed meditation is necessary, but it is primarily this wisdom or insight, discerning emptiness, that you are able to achieve liberation. And when this wisdom realizing emptiness is supported by the development of bodhicitta, then that leads to achieving enlightenment. So in order to achieve that special insight into the ultimate reality, you need to first cultivate come abiding meditation, one-pointed meditation. And in order to engage in successful practice of the union of come abiding and the special insight, you need to cultivate a genuine altruism, bodhicitta. And based on come abiding and through special insight, when you continue your meditation and then gradually you develop the physical and mental pliancy, and then gradually you actualize the union of come abiding and special insight, and having achieved that union of come abiding and special insight, then at that point, even when you engage in analytical meditation and discriminative awareness, that also helps you strengthen your one-pointed meditation. So therefore, when you actualize such a union of come abiding special insight, and particularly such a union with reference to emptiness, then you are able to develop a very powerful insight through which you are able to remove the three objects of elimination of the path of seeing, and then you actualize the path of seeing at whose point you actualize the path of you actualize the first bodhisattva level, and then gradually you proceed in actualizing all the ten spiritual grounds. So it is in this way that it is through the cultivation of special insight that you are able to eliminate the root cause of samsara, and you are able to remove not only the seeds, not only the afflictive emotions, but also the seeds. And then when you engage in removing even the imprints left behind by such afflictive emotions and seeds, and then gradually you are able to get rid of the imprints in the form of dualistic appearances, and then you actualize the ultimate state of Buddhahood, which is a state of having all the four bodies of the Buddha. And in order to undertake the practice of such a complete unmistaken path right from the beginning, when we are on a very ordinary state, it's important to develop some understanding, comprehensive understanding of this whole path. And then in your daily practice, you should try to reflect on this whole process, even though you may be focused on the special practice that you may be involved in. So it is in this way you should make sure that you have a comprehensive understanding of the whole path. And therefore it becomes pertinent and important to follow and read a text which explains this complete unmistaken path. And therefore we are reading here the great stages of the path by Tsongkhapa. And in terms of me as a teacher who is explaining this, I really feel privileged and fortunate to be able to explain such a text. And you should, as a listener, also take this as a great privilege, because it is a text teaching that has all the blessing, and that contains all the summary practices of the important sutra and vast and profound sutra teachings coming right down from the Buddha. So this is really like the refined essence of the more than 100 volumes of the words of Buddha himself and more than 250 volumes of the commentaries of the Buddha's words. And particularly when it deals with the section on cultivating the philosophical view, the special insight, he explains it in greater detail by clearly distinguishing the subtle philosophical differences and the possible mistaken areas. So in order to properly understand this great special insight, you should also read the smaller special insight, which is explained in the small stages of the path. And then this should also be supplemented by reading the commentary of the Nagarjuna's Fundamental Wisdom by Tsongkhapa, which is really a great important text. And then you should also read the commentary of Madhyamika Avatara, again by Tsongkhapa, and then also the text that Tsongkhapa himself had composed, which is not a commentary to any text, but something that he had himself composed, which is known as the Elegant Teachings, which discusses about the essence of elegant teachings, which is a text on the interpretative and definitive meaning, primarily delineating the important points of the Mahadul view of the Mahadul school of thought and the Madhyamika thought. So these five texts are something that you must study comparing to each other. And also if you study them systematically, first the great special insight from the great stages of the path, then the elegant sayings, then Nagarjuna's fundamental wisdom, and then illuminating the thought commentary to the Madhyamika Avatara, and then the smaller section on the special insight. So this is actually how he had composed the texts at different periods of time. And so what you will find in the later text that he had composed is that whatever he has not explained, not in not so clear terms, is explained in the subsequent texts. So therefore it is really important to study these five texts. So at least you should study the great special insight and the elegant teachings, at least these two texts. And this elegant teaching on the interpretative and definitive teaching is also a kind of philosophical tenet system, where he talks primarily about the philosophical view of the Mahadul school of thought and the Madhyamika school of thought. And while explaining those views, he also very often comes up with the views of the Rabishigas and so forth. And in that you will find primarily the thought of Shantarakshita, Kamala Shila, Baba Viveka, Chandakirti and so forth. So once I urge you and tell you about the importance of studying the text, so whether you come from Japan or from Thailand or from Taiwan or from China or from Korea or from wherever, since we all follow the Buddha's teaching, it's important for all of us to realize the importance of studying. And luckily we have so many texts are available. And in many cases, for example, in your case, some of the old texts that you may have you may find a little bit archaic in terms of the usage of terms, in which case you will be able to find much help if you read some of the Tibetan commentaries and their translations. And particularly today, since we have such good facilities, and therefore it's important to study more. And then in the case of the Tibetans, we should also make endeavor to study texts that is available in Pali and also in Sanskrit. So it is important to engage in this kind of mutual study relationship. And as I said, now we are entering the 21st century, where the connection towards each other is becoming more and more closer. And within this context, in terms of the study programs of the Tibetans are concerned, all of us, irrespective of whether you are a lay person or an ordinary person, it is important for us, the Tibetans, also to study some of the important modern knowledges, and particularly the scientific presentations and the presentations found in physics and so forth. For example, as far as some of the explanations on material objects are concerned, what is being explained in Buddhism is not so detailed. So in that connection, it's important to study subjects like physics and so forth. I must mention this point because sometimes because of your short-sightedness, you might feel that there is nothing else to study from other other people or other sources, and you might remain under the illusion that you have everything and that there is nothing else that other people can write about. And in the past in Tibet, as far as the standard of education is, education on Buddhism is concerned, it's really not very good. And whether you really want to show faith to the teaching of the Buddha or not is totally up to you. But if you know the main essential teachings of the Buddha's teaching, that will really help you, at least to some extent, a person with more open mind and a broader perspective, and particularly in Tibet. Today, a lot of material progresses are being about by the Chinese, and they are quite busy in that regard. Then today, it's not only among the Tibetans, but number of Chinese are showing, more and more Chinese are showing interest in the teaching of the Buddha, and therefore it is now the task of the Tibetans to know the teaching of the Buddha and to be able to explain it. If you are able to do that, then while on the one hand there is material progress, at the same time you will have this spiritual development and progress. And if you don't know the teaching of the Buddha, and if you think that it is another die-hard tradition or custom, and then the more and more you get busy with worldly material concerns and activities, then you might gradually take this spiritual Buddhist studies as an old habit which may not be so relevant. In this way, you might neglect it and discard it. So therefore, knowledge is really important. Just to give an example, around 1960s, a number of Tibetans went to Switzerland. That was the first Tibetan settlement in a Western country. And so at that point, as soon as they reached Switzerland, then in the case of many of Tibetans who really had no in-depth understanding of the Buddha's teaching, they got so attracted to this material development there and the nice surroundings there, they commented, probably that is this is what is the heaven that we speak about. So, on the other hand, if you are someone who has really good understanding of the teaching of the Buddha, then you will not be so attracted by these material marvels. Because you see the fading glory, you see the impermanence, you see the essencelessness. Because you have this wider perspective, long-term perspective, and if you have that long-term, wider perspective, then of course you will use those material benefits, but you will not think that this is all. So when you are devoid of such understanding, and if you think that religious practice is like a tradition, then when you are reach such a surrounding, then you think this is the pure realm, and you might even think that Tibetans are backward and undeveloped. And if you are someone who has this internal spiritual development, then of course you will appreciate those material facilities, but at the same time you will not get discouraged by thinking about your own spiritual cultural tradition. And when we also, when we first came into India, and we did have some young Tibetans who commented that it was wrong that I am born as a Tibetan. And then, of course, to some extent, there is some element of truth because we didn't have much education and so forth, and we didn't speak the language here. But then gradually, with the passage of time, when we had an opportunity to exchange our Buddhist knowledge and so forth, then our Indian social study is showing much respect. And of course, in the initial stage when we came into India, even some of these great learned Buddhist monks and scholars, they do not know how to write. So when they were there, whenever there is a need to put their signature, they don't know how to put their signature. So they had to put their thumb impression. So then our host, many of our people in the host country thought that these are just ignorant people, so we need to give them education, you know, they are still not a human being. But then gradually when they realized how highly mentally developed these people are, then they started showing more respect and more interest. So in this way, if you have some knowledge of the teaching of the Buddha, then you can really show the unique qualities of the Tibetans, and that will help you not remain discouraged, and you will have confidence within yourself. So it is really the task of the Tibetans to, as I said earlier, if you don't want to have faith in religion, that's fine. You can even be anti-religion, that's fine. But if you have some idea about the teaching of the Buddha, then even if you become if you remain against the Buddha's teaching, your anti-activities will become more effective. And I remember this article that is written against me, saying that the Dalai Lama is the separatist. And now to prove this point, so finally that article that they had written to prove that I am a spiritist, you know, to prove this point, they cited one quotation from Nagarjuna's Fundamental Wisdom, where it says, even the Nagarjuna says that things are not separate and not one. But they didn't quote this, not one, but they didn't say not separate. So clearly revealing their deep amount of ignorance. So even these people now gradually showing interest. For example, this Chinese leader Tao Ziya, who recently passed away, just before his passing away, he sent a message from someone saying, requesting me to pray for him. And also I heard Zhang Zemin having much interest in Buddhism. And I heard Li Fang's daughter also has much interest in Buddhism. So truth never becomes old. If it is a right thing, it is truth, then with the passage of time, it becomes more and more clear and more powerful. If it is not truth, then it's like an iron. The more you keep it, it will get rusted. So in the case of the Tibetans, as we normally say, that one that the Tibetan can show about, one that Tibetan can display, and one that Tibetans can proudly talk about, call it Buddhist culture, it is primarily the Buddha's teaching. Then other kind of Buddhist cultures, minor clippings, minor Buddhist cultures like wearing long earrings and so forth, these are minor, really doesn't really matter. And I recall this young person, Tibetan, who came from Switzerland, and he came to see me. When he first entered my office with his long hair, long hanging hair, and with his jeans, tight jeans and so forth, the first impression was not so encouraging. But when he sat before, me and started talking about Tibetans, I was completely amazed how nationalistic and how determined and how highly spirited he is about the Tibetan culture and religion. And then he started crying before me. So I think that is what really is important. That is the Tibetan culture. Tibetan culture has to be there in the mind. Not, it should not be limited to some external expressions. Now even if you watch some of these Tibetan cultural dances, you will find most of the songs, songs convey the message, message of the teaching of the Buddha. And talks about Tibetan culture, talks about violence, talks about Tibetan peace. And then I do feel there may be some element of truth in saying that if you watch a genuine Tibetan dance, you will see some kind of a peaceful environment with the way they sing and with the gesture of the body, the hand and so forth. There is some, I think, element of peace and calmness. So irrespective of those things, what is really important is the internal knowledge and understanding, particularly the knowledge of the teaching of the Buddha. If you have that knowledge, then you can easily go hand in hand with everybody in the world, and you can also go in hand in hand with material development. So therefore, to Buddha's teaching should not be limited in reciting simply Om Mani Padme Hum or simply saying I take refuge to Buddha Dharma and Sangha. So such kind of practices are found in all other religious traditions in the world. There is such devotion in Christian religion, such devotion in Islam religion and so forth. So what probably is unique in Buddhism is that it is such a profound and vast philosophical view. So now when we talk about the philosophical tenet systems, all his philosophical viewpoints are primarily rooted in developing compassion, love and so forth. So, as a person, if you have no interest in religion, you don't have to call yourself as a Buddhist, but you should study and understand the essence. So I once urge you to study. So remember this, and then after today's teaching, when you go back to your respective places, I really urge you to study. To meditate, to study, to understand. Even in the case of very elderly people who do not have a very good eyesight, even in your case, you should make an effort and hear this view of other people saying that His Holiness or Dalai Lama has told me to read, to study. And so those of you who go back to Tibet, also make those texts that I've just mentioned available in abundance so that other people can read. And these great stages of the path, that we are studying here today, as I said, is the tradition of the fortunate beings having many great features. The greatness of the teacher, greatness of the teaching, and the process of guiding the student through the instruction. So there's no need for me to repeat all of those again. In the case of the actual instruction, it deals with the teaching to the three individuals, and we have been reading the section on the special insight, which belongs to the practice of the great stages of the path. The special insight primarily discusses about the view of the mind only school of thought, and particularly the Madhyamika viewpoint. And within the Madhyamika viewpoint, there are two. One Madhyamika system, which accepts inherent existence, at least at the conventional level, and then there is the Prasangika Madhyamika viewpoint, which does not accept inherent existence even at the conventional level. So today we'll start by developing or receiving the Bodhisattva vow. When you have cultivated aspirational bodhicitta and then develop a strong desire to engage in the practice of the bodhisattva way of life, then at that point you should receive the bodhisattva vow. Bodhisattva vow primarily means that you make a vow and a commitment not just for yourself but for the sake of all sentient beings, and where you dedicate your body, speech and mind so that your body, speech and mind becomes a source of benefit to all sentient beings. And having received such a bodhisattva vow, then ensure that you are not defiled by the infractions of the secondary and root commitments. So if you do so, then even with the change of life, bodhisattva vow is not lost. And even in the case if you degenerated root vows, you can restore it, unlike the individual Pratimoksha vows. And such bodhisattva vows, if possible, you should receive from your Lama, and if not possible, you can also receive it before a holy image. The text or the method by which you receive such a bodhisattva vow can be done relying on many sources, one that is found in Bodhisattva Bhumi, one that is found in Shantideva's compendium of training, and then there is also a concise way of doing it from the Bodhicharya of Dara by Shantideva. Then there is also, I think, a process of receiving it in the a sutra by Buddha, which is called Jambe Number Rolvendo, the support of Manjushri Sutra. And you can also receive it in relation to a tantric mandala. And today, Bodhisattva vow will be conferred from Bodhisattva spiritual level, from the chapter on ethical discipline. And this is interpreted in Tsongkhapa's text on the ethical discipline. I have received it from my senior tutor, late senior tutor Lingyo Rinpoche, who had received it from the holy sacred image of Buddha from Bodh Gaya. I think this practice seems to have lost in the Beluk schools. This process of receiving the Bodhisattva vow from the Bodhisattva Bhumi, and that is there in Kham area and also in Sakya area. And sometimes people use the term, the system of the Mandal school of thought and the system of the Madhyamika school of thought. So this process of receiving Bodhisattva vow from the Bodhisattva vow is very clearly explained in Tsongkhapa's commentary on that chapter on the ethical discipline. And Tsongkhapa, in both of his two stages of the path, mentions that if you are interested, study this in my commentary on the ethical discipline. And then I felt it's very important to restore it, and therefore I received it from my late senior tutor Lingyo Rinpoche. First is making a supplication, and you make this request and supplication from a Lama who is skilled in the Mahayana precepts and who knows the ritual of conferring such a Bodhisattva vow and who himself possesses such a Bodhisattva vow. And in my case, I am someone who has a genuine interest in the aspirational bodhicitta and has some familiarity, and I every day perform the self-entry and receive the bodhisattva vow. And on this morning also I did receiving the bodhisattva vow. And then with, as far as the learnedness on Mahayana sutras, I cannot say that I am a learned man. And in terms of the recipient, what should be the qualifications? He should be someone who is not too excessively attached to worldly comforts and attractions. As we have been discussing during the last many days, while reading the great stages of the path, we discussed about how to train to aspire for happiness for many future lives, and how to train your mind to achieve liberation and to achieve omniscience. So all of you, in the case of all of you, I'm sure that you have some kind of understanding about the sacredness and the value of bodhicitta, and you, I'm sure all of you have some idea about the importance of this bodhicitta as the most important practice, even though it may not be so difficult to practice. At least I am sure that you have that kind of feeling right now. But tomorrow and day after tomorrow, when you leave this place, how much you will be able to recall the preciousness of this mind, I do not know. And particularly in the case of the Tibetans who came from Tibet, when you cross this border from Dham, then far from being able to remembering bodhicitta and bodhisattva vow, your mind may be instilled with fear, doubt, anxiety and so forth. But even if you are able to cultivate this mind for one day, for a short time, that will do a lot of goodness in removing your fear, doubt, afflictions and so forth. But I must tell you that sometimes people have this, among the people there are some who have this tendency that they want to do the best in the shortest time. So that I think is not so impractical. Because some people, they have so much overconfidence that they want to overreach and get the best thing. But then that best thing is not so easy to get. And then they fail and they don't do any practice. Take the example of food. No one will say that if I want the best food, if I don't get the best food, I am not going to eat it. I am going to starve myself. So I think it is wiser, first of all, to get something to make you alive, to help you remain alive, rather than waiting for the best food. And take the example of Milarepa. When he was remaining in that empty cave undertaking his practice, he didn't say that I'm going to die until I get the best food. All that he had was nettle soup. So once you get habituated with some of these smaller practices that you are able to do, then gradually you can strengthen and prolong your practice. Repeat this request. Master, listen to me. I, from you, would like to receive the ethical bodhisattva vow. And if there is no obstruction, be kind to me and grant me this bodhisattva vow. Repeat this three times. Sanju Sembe Surimji Dumba Yanda Valawa Never Seji Tel Never Majina Bala Tuze Viledu Josechi Severixo Lobo Gonzo Bao Chule Sanju Sembe Surimji Dumba Yanda Valawa Never say ji, tell never imagine. Tu se ve ledo. Tu se ji se ve rikso. Then I ask a question. Now this vow of ethical discipline of a bodhisattva that you have wished to receive from me, are you going to receive this with the expectation that in the next life you will get a good human rebirth or achieving liberation? If so, then this is not a good motivation. You should receive this bodhisattva vow to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. In the case of the Tibetans, you think that this includes all sentient beings, including the so-called your enemy. And you should receive this bodhisattva vow to liberate sentient beings from the samsara, to help them achieve higher status, to help them achieve liberation, and to help them achieve omniscience. So you should reflect in this way. So since that is what you need to think, so my question is, do you have this to free those who are not free, liberate those that are not liberated, and so forth? Then you should answer me. And when you answer, you should primarily think that I will help all sentient beings achieve Buddhahood, and I have this desire to help them get liberated from afflictive obscurations and cognitive obscurations, and of this wish to help all of them achieve enlightenment. So with that kind of idea, answer my question. Dola. 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 In this way, when you have cultivated this mind to help all sentient beings achieve enlightenment, once you develop such a mind, then you become a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is one who wholeheartedly endeavors to achieve the Buddhahood, and he is referred as the child of a bodhisattva. So having cultivated that mind, you have become, you are saying that I will become one of the followers of the Buddha, to whom the Buddha can trust. And therefore, when I ask you, are you someone who really wants to maintain the lineage of the Buddha, the continuity of the teaching of the Buddha? If I speak this more clearly, then I am asking you, are you going to become a student, a reliable student of the Nagarjuna, of Haryadeva, of Buddha? And then in the case of the Tibetans, you should think that I will become a follower of all those great Tibetan masters, a reliable student of Tsongkhapa. So with that kind of idea, then you should answer by saying that I desire that Dola. Having cultivated, if you have cultivated such an outlook, and then the Lama can confer the Bodhisattva vow. Next is asking whether you are free from obstructions and hindrances for cultivating such a Bodhisattva vow. And before doing that, the Lama also explains the benefits of cultivation of receiving such a Bodhisattva vow. As we have discussed already in Tsongkhapa's great stages of the path, the benefit of cultivating Bodhisattva is so much that it cannot be measured even by your making countless offerings to infinite Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in infinite realms, and particularly at this point, to cultivate such a Bodhisattva vow at this time of degeneration is very special. And as I said earlier, there is no other path and method to achieve omniscience than cultivating bodhicitta and receiving bodhisattva vow, and there is no other skillful method that is better than cultivating bodhisattva vow and bodhicitta in helping other sentient beings. Before you receive bodhisattva vow, I suggest not to leave. This is a very important moment. Don't miss this opportunity. And having cultivated bodhicitta and received bodhisattva vow, you should not intentionally neglect the well-being and welfare of any sentient being, even the tiniest insects. You should always endeavor to bring about their welfare and well-being. And with regard to the precepts, I will receive these 20 verses of Bodhisattva vow. I have the explanatory transmission of this. There is an annotation written by Paulo Rinpoche, and I have received this explanatory commentary from my junior tutor, Tijan Rinpoche. So listen to this oral explanatory transmission. First is paying homage to Manjushri. The text opens with Maharaj paying homage to Manjushri, and then making offerings and paying homage to Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So these are the preliminary practices for receiving Bodhisattva vow. You should imagine Buddhas and Bodhisattvas as actually present in before you, as we have done while cultivating aspiration of bodhicitta, and then you should accumulate merit and purify your negative deeds. And then in the case of the ethical discipline that you are going to receive, to all the Buddhas of the 10 directions and of the 3 times, all these Bodhisattvas have cultivated such a Bodhisattva vow in the past, and they are cultivating it now, and they will cultivate it in the future, and all these Bodhisattvas will regard this Bodhicitta and Bodhisattva vow as precious as their own life, and which is really like the treasure house of collection of merit. And it should be received from a Lama who abides in such a Bodhisattva vow. And once you receive such a Bodhisattva, you please all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and they will see you as their only child. And with regard to observing such a vow, you should, the main essence of the instruction is that you should do something that is beneficial in long term. In short, if it is something that is beneficial to the sentient beings in the long run as well as temporarily, then without hesitation do those actions, do those acts. And if it is not so, it creates some kind of difficulty, inconvenience temporarily, but brings benefit in the long run, also do those. And if it brings inconvenience temporarily and in the long run, you must not do those. And if it is temporarily beneficial and harmful in the long run, then don't do that also. So that is the summary. And then the text explains about the 18 root infractions, and that is as explained in the 6th session Guru Yoga. So that is praising oneself, defaming others and so forth. This is found in the 6th session Guru Yoga. Praising oneself, defaming others, and not giving wealth and teaching Dharma teaching, and not apologizing when someone sincerely asks for forgiveness. And then discarding the Mahayana teaching, and then snatching and robbing offerings to Buddha, and robbing the saffron robes of Sanghas, engaging in heinous crimes, and developing wrong view, destroying cities and so forth, and giving teaching on emptiness to those whose minds are not trained. And then and discouraging others who are on the path to enlightenment, and then giving up the pratimoksha vows, and defaming the sarvakas and patikas, and telling lies on profound meanings, and then also receiving offerings receiving offerings that are made to the three objects of refuge. And then coming out with wrong disciplines and laws. And then giving up aspirational bodhicitta. And that is the 18th root infraction. So these are the 18 root infractions. And if you commit these wrong infractions, it is a cause for being born in the great hell. So out of these 18 root infractions, there are two, which is the wrong view and giving up aspiration of bodhicitta. In the case of these two, as soon as you cultivate them, you lose your bodhisattva vow. In the rest of the 16, simply by cultivating them, you do not lose bodhisattva vow. But if you cultivate this, if you commit these 16 with the four entanglements, then you lose bodhisattva. The four entanglements are, if you engage in the 16 root infractions without having a wish to engage into it and not seeing the faults of them, and when you commit them with great joy in the mind, great delight in the mind, and when you do those with no sense of shame and embarrassment, so these are four entanglements.